Thursday, February 21st, 2013. Today we're going to continue public testimony of the governor's education budget. And we have four testifiers listed. And if there's anyone else, you know, please let us know. At the bottom of the agenda, members, you'll see that we do have handouts posted electronically. And if so, for anyone that's viewing or for members that want to look wherever they are to see some of the documents that's available, we appreciate staff facilitating that. Our first testifier is Roger Aronson, representing the Minnesota School Principals Association. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm happy to be here. As it says on the list there, I represent the Elementary School Principals Association and the Secondary School Principals Association. This is 1,700 school principals and assistant principals throughout Minnesota, and we're here to testify in support of the governor's bill, Senate File 453, for a couple of reasons that I want to highlight to you. I don't know that I can add anything particularly new to what some of the other folks will tell you about this bill, but I do want to tell you a little bit about the perspective from school principals on this. First of all, money on the formula, as happens in the first year, and the money that special education funding money that appears primarily in the second year of the bill, this converts directly into staffing for us. Staffing for teachers, staffing for principals, assistant principals, counselors, school psychologists, paras, all down the line. And that is important. When we're talking about providing educational services to students, we can't do it without the people. And we look at this as converting right into people. We know that the amounts of money that are involved here are not huge increases. And as the committee knows, we're in the middle of a cycle where there's a significant pension fund bailout, 0.5% per year on payroll that the districts have to pay, and then out of the employee share of that as well. So these monies are going to help keep us primarily at the status quo where we are with some slight increases in some areas. And we really need these. And we look at this as part of a long-term trend. We need to do this 2 years from now as well, and 4 years from now as well, and 6 years from now as well. This is not a one-stop deal in fixing schools. This needs to be a long-term solution and retrospectively as well. A couple of things that we are very interested in this bill. Both the elementary principals and the secondary principals are strong supporters of all-day kindergarten. The extent that the bill moves us on that journey to making that universal in Minnesota, we think that is a very worthwhile investment. We're interested in the monies that are going to be made available to districts in the second year that are, I don't know if you want to say alternatives to QComp, but for districts that do not receive QComp revenue, that they'll receive some monies and that there's a policy decision here to direct that into teacher evaluation, we think that's good. And frankly, and I know Senator Stumpf has for many years championed that we need to loosen the strings on the QComp money for rural districts as well. And I represent a lot of rural principals, and QComp money is primarily centered in the urban area and the metropolitan area. That's because these districts have large staffs that are able to draft the grants, follow up on those grants. School districts that are smaller out there really can't do that, and so they haven't been able to access that revenue. To the extent this is a step in that direction, it's a good first step. We'd like to see a lot more, and we'd like to keep that discussion alive as we go on. There is some discussion of setting up the center that's going to look at bullying prevention and other issues. We're excited about that. You're going to hear about the bullying bill and the as things go on here down the weeks. But to the extent that there's some talk about curriculum and training that can come for school districts and that the department would be a center for that, we think that's a very good thing, and we're supportive of that as well. One minor thing that we want you to take a peek at, a couple of years ago, there was an early graduation scholarship program that was enacted. There were some problems with funding that early graduation scholarship program. And so the fix that went in last year was that when students graduate early, we discontinue the foundation aid formula at that time. In the old days, if the student graduated early, we still got the funding to the end of the year for that student. You say, well, why do you need the funding if the child's gone? We still have the teachers. We still have the bus. We still have the heating costs, all of that infrastructure. And this is something that in your districts, you might have one school that has no early graduations. You might have another one that has 25 early graduations. And if you have that, if you have 25 and the kid's gone, you know, mid-year, it's going to cost you some money, and we're going to lay some people off. And we have visited with the department about that as well to reinstate those monies. We think it's about $1 million. And so as you go on looking at this, it's something we'd like you to consider. It came out in order to fund those early graduations. This proposal now ends those early graduation scholarships, so we think we should have that money as well, Mr. Chairman. So overall, we do heartily support this bill and thank the governor and your efforts as well, Mr. Chair, as we move through the process. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Johnson.
One question on the early grad scholarship. And I'm not familiar with that program, but from just your statements, I heard of a student who graduated more than a year early. Would the aid or the aid continue until what would have been the end of the 12th grade?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I'm not an expert on that, but I don't think so. I think it's a school year matter. Okay. in the year. I think that's how that would go.
And I have one Senator other.
Johnson.
It's a statement really about the QComp and teacher eval. I'm very interested in that area. But I had a call from... I graduated from Foley High School out near St. Cloud, and I had a call from a teacher who was from Foley who was on the committee that worked on teacher eval. But he said they have a really great QComp. They're using QComp, and it's very successful in their school. Now, Foley is a very small school, and so whatever they're doing is working for them. He was very pleased with it, but concerned about the teacher eval and how that would work with the QComp. So just wanted to let you know that some of the small districts outstate are successful with that program.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Johnson. Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the going back to the previous question, I think the question that we wrestle with is how to create an incentive, and once that incentive works, do you take it away or do you continue that incentive to make it, you know, kind of a not a loss at least to the school district? And I think the same issue is enters in when we talk about PSEO. When you have high school students going to a college, they quite often will negotiate a price or a cost between the school district and the college for those students that go there. But you have two unhappy partners. You have the school district who loses a student and partial aid, and you have the college who probably doesn't get adequately funded because of their costs, you know, are just, you know, they're going to be paid less than what they would get for traditional college students. So I think there has to be some way to keep both parties in the loop and happy, or at least somewhat satisfied. Otherwise, these programs won't work. and maybe there's a possibility that you can fund the program and continue the subsidy, so to speak, without making it look like it's a double dip. And I think that's the question we wrestle with is somebody coming in and saying, oh, this school district has taken advantage of that because now they're getting paid twice for the same student.
Mr. Harrison.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, at the heart of the discussion, you know, is that we have a funding system that's based on how many kids you have. And it's not based on what the cost is of providing the services. And if you continue to grow, it's a great system. You know, but as any of these types of mechanisms, eventually when you run out of the growth, then you have some problematic pieces. And one of them, and a lot of these are at the edges. I do think you're absolutely right. And PSCO is a very good example about that. PSCO is, on the one side, was a very popular, it continues to be a very popular program to get credits for students that are basically paid for by the state. On the other hand, the school's response was to create college in the schools, which has been very successful and very solid, and keeps kids there at the high schools, and we deliver the credits there. And so then we looked at another way to provide, you know, those credits and then not have the kids moving and off the campus and that sort of thing. So you're right. It's an ongoing dance that you do every year here. You actually are quite good at it, but you do it every year, and it's interesting. And this is another good example of that particular bill. And sometimes there are a little unintended consequence, you know, as well. And that's what we're trying to correct. But I think you're right. The QComp, and Senator Johnson mentioned that Foley has it. That's, you know, there are a lot of districts that just aren't able to put the grants together and, you know, make the applications, et cetera, et cetera. As you explore what is that revenue about and what should it be used for, the nice thing about you as the policymakers is you get to decide how that revenue should be used and what are the standards for extending it to folks, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, and it's a good program all the way around, we think.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, I believe you're representing the high school league.
Mr. Chair.
I'd like to share just particularly for new members that may ever have questions on local inquiries. I'd like to give a few highlights on how the league's doing.
I think the league's doing very well, Mr. Chair, and members. I think one of the things, the league solves a lot of problems for the legislature. And when you think about that in terms of handling eligibility pieces and the experience, we have 80,000 students that participate in extracurricular activities that are monitored through the high school league. We do it all internally with the funding. There is no state grant for that. And the legislature through the years, Chapter 128C, has significant oversight of the league. We're subject to the open meeting law, the Government Data Practices Act, those sorts of things. Interestingly enough, that you ask, you will as other bills come before you. There's a provision in the governor's tax bill that I think will interest all of you. Your high schools and schools do not charge admission tickets, sales tax on admission tickets, and there's an exemption for that for the school play, for the basketball games, for the high school league, et cetera, et cetera. The high school league has an arrangement that was set up with the legislature where our sales tax exposure would be $700,000 a year. We don't pay that as a result of an exemption. We put that in a foundation, the Minnesota State High School League Foundation. So they get $700,000 a year. All of that money goes back to school districts. We subsidize participation fees on school district basis. We provide for projects for individual schools. And those provisions, both the admission into high school events and the high school league's exemption, those are repealed in the governor's tax proposal. So you'll start to hear this as that percolates through the world about charging sales tax to get into the basketball games and the school plays and those sorts of things, as you will with other things. But that is of concern to us as well. But overall, I think things are very good, and the Minnesota State High School League is looking forward to, in 2015 will be their centennial. And so we're looking forward to that as well, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Aronson, I don't know if Senator Hand's bill will get a hearing,
but I'm a
co-author of that bill this
yes.
year, and just wanted to raise it to the attention of the committee. The issue where in the conference that my schools are in, which is the Classic Lake Conference, mm-hmm. we have a problem of getting other school districts to be willing to play with, for example, Wayzata, which I represent, and Eden Prairie. I also represent Hopkins, which has a little bit of a problem, but not as much. And so our kids, because the school districts, you know, don't want to play them, have to go all around the country to find their games. And so this bill actually says that the league is responsible for making sure that everybody has to play each other.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I apologize that I haven't talked to you about that yet. I did visit with Dave Stead, the executive director of the High School League, upon the introduction of that. And we have scheduled a meeting for tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock with the athletic directors of all of those school districts to come in and talk about getting that scheduling done. We did visit with the policy committee to say we're going to try to get that resolved before it would have to be here for a hearing.
Good.
So we think
you.
We can fix that problem.
Good.
Yes.
That's a hot potato.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Aronson. Superintendent Richardson from Northfield Schools, welcome.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Chris Richardson. I'm the superintendent of the Northfield Public Schools. I'm currently completing my 32nd year as a school superintendent, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I've also had experience in districts from 250 students K-12 to over 22,000 students K-12. So I've got a fairly good background in terms of looking at education over a long period of time. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share some thoughts from MASA concerning this bill and the governor's education budget. I need to begin by saying that I think as an organization we continue to be concerned about the ability of our state to fulfill its constitutional duty to establish a general and uniform, thorough and efficient system of public schools. As a system, we are becoming the ability to fund is becoming increasingly inadequate, and that's driving local school districts more and more because the revenue is not available through state funding to go back to their communities and look at voter-approved referenda to successfully offset those revenue shortages. And the concern, obviously, is that that's very inequitable across the state because of the situation that some districts are able to readily get those levies passed, others struggle, and the impact has been significant. The shortages we've seen as school districts really are both in terms of general education funding and in terms of special education funding. I guess we want to thank the governor for his support of K-12 education, recognize him for presenting to the legislature two consecutive budgets that have significantly looked at increasing funding for K-12 students across our state. But despite those efforts, I think as I talk to my colleagues across the state of Minnesota, there are continuing mounting budget problems requiring significant cuts in educational services and staff. And as we review the governor's budget, we would recommend considering the following budget revisions to more successfully meet these funding needs. We hear that from both districts as large as Anoka-Hennepin to very small districts across the state that really are struggling with how to continue to fund their schools. So first, we would suggest that the committee and the legislature look at the increase of general fund revenue basic formula to a level that truly recognizes the costs of educating students in the state of Minnesota. As we look at the basic formula amount, it really is the driver in terms of funding for our kids, and it is lagged behind inflation over the last 20 years. We look at the current level at $5,224 a pupil. We would need to increase that amount by over $2,000 per pupil to provide the same buying power we had for education back in 1991-92. That basic formula is crucial to every school district because if we really think about it, the great majority of the non-referendum general education revenue comes from this source. Basic amount must more accurately reflect the true costs of educating students in our state. While we obviously appreciate the governor's proposed 1% increase, you need to be very clear that it does not fully address the need to even match the current inflationary rate, nor will it have any impact on reducing the long-term funding deficit that we have in the state in terms of education. Districts will continue to be forced to seek revenue from voter-approved referendum levies if state funding isn't significant. And the results will be inconsistent funding support and inequitable treatment for students and taxpayers across the state. Second, I think it's very important that as a legislature, you look at The governor's proposal in terms of providing increased funding for all-day kindergarten, increased flexibility in accessing funding for early childhood programs, including all-day kindergarten. Again, we would reinforce the fact that as educators, we see this as a very positive step in terms of putting more dollars into that early childhood and the kindergarten level. We know that has a significant positive impact on our ability to meet the needs of kids. We, however, need to be clear that in terms of looking at that kindergarten funding, if we're funding at not the full cost per teacher, but only 7/10 instead of the 0.55, we're still not where we need to be to really move us to where we could provide all-day kindergarten across every district in the state. I think it's also really important that as a legislature, you continue to think about flexibility. Understand that there are districts that would like to fund or provide all-day kindergarten but don't have the facilities to do so, and maybe have not been able to pass a bond issue or to do other things to provide additional spaces. We also have a number of districts that have, in very creative ways, looked to providing high-quality preschool programming for at-risk kids. I think it's very important that as we think about the all-day kindergarten funding, that we think about it in ways that provides the greatest flexibility for each local district to figure out what works best for them. And that if the focus is really wanting to move to all-day kindergarten for every child, the funding level needs to be such that you're really putting the dollars there to make that happen. Third, I guess we think it's extremely important that we provide adequate funding to fully implement the high-quality evaluation for every teacher and principal. As one of the 17 school districts that's currently participating in the pilot principal evaluation process, and having just been through and with the MDE, a review of the new default teacher evaluation process, we would say to you that the cost of those efforts is going to be significantly greater than the $22 per student that's being identified in the bill and in the governor's budget. We want to have high-quality evaluation of our teachers and our administrators. But we also know that when, even at a minimum for teachers, we'd be looking at least five different kinds of evaluation activities for each teacher every year under the default model. The ability to do that with the limited amount of dollars that we're proposing is not going to give us the quality that we have. And we know there's a significant difference between districts that have been able to introduce QCOMP, either from a perspective of the writing of the proposal or from the perspective of getting the approval of both the board and the association and moving forward. So we just think it's extremely important that as you think about a mandate, and this is a new set of mandates on the part of the state, and I think mandates that local school districts want to see happen, that we think about making sure that we have the dollars to address the fact that this is going to take more administrative time and more teacher time, because peer mentorship is a big part of this process and will take teachers out of the classrooms who then provide that support. Fourth, I think we need to have you continue to think about the increase in special education formula. That's an extremely important piece for us, both in terms of basic and the excess cost portions, to adequately meet the needs of school districts that are mandated to provide these programs to meet the needs of our special ed students. The governor's 13% increase and 13% increase identified in this bill makes an excellent first effort to reduce the current special education cross-subsidy and hopefully try to stem the escalating diversion of general fund revenue to pay for special education costs. We know that that negatively impacts every single district in the state. So if there is one area where support could really have a positive impact on every school district, it would be in addressing trying to provide more funding for special education. Right now, without this funding, the rapidly increasing special education costs far outstrip a district's ability to pay for them. Additional revenue needed to fully fund the basic and excess portions of special education formula is estimated to be $88 million and $92 million, respectively, for each of the next two fiscal years. When you add that to the special ed costs that are not covered by formulas, school districts today are basically transferring over $600 million from their general funds to pay for special education in each of the next 2 years. That's a huge amount of money drawn away from being able to provide basic programming. As in the case of inadequate general ed basic formula funding, when you fail to fully fund special education, forces districts, again, to seek additional revenue through the passage of voter-approved levies. And so the best way to reduce reliance on referendum levy is to fully fund special ed. Finally, I guess I would like to speak to a piece that is not in the bill, but of which we have a great deal of concern because it was in the task force, and that is the issue of equity. We know today that low property wealth districts require higher levels of tax effort than those high property wealth school districts to raise an equal amount of revenue. Minnesota has a tradition of trying to equalize those levies so property wealth differences don't create widely disparate value levels of opportunity. But that tradition has really been eroded over the last 20 years because we haven't changed the formula amounts in calculation. And as a result, what we're seeing now is an increasing gap between the 5th and the 95th percentiles of funding. And that continues to grow dramatically. I think Minnesota needs to increase property tax equalization formulas and ensure the taxpayers throughout the state are treated fairly when it comes to education-related levies. Unfortunately, the governor's budget in this bill does not address this issue. And so those are pieces that, as members of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, we'd like to share with you. Again, we appreciate the overall thrust of this bill and the overall thrust of the governor's budget. Obviously, additional dollars for education is extremely important for us, but we also hope that you will consider at least some of these issues as you go forward. I'd stand for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Superintendent. Questions? Senator Hoffman, followed by Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Richardson, good to see you again.
Good morning, sir.
I remember you and I have served on Congressman Ramstad's Education Advisory Panel.
Many years ago, yes.
Couple of things, and please correct me. It's my understanding there are about 47 school districts that are at zero now regarding the levy.
Correct.
And as so that is a correct. Can you briefly tell us just, you know, regarding the impact that had specifically on those districts that went from, you know, whether it be Clearbrook at 600 down to zero, you know, what did that do for a typical classroom? What did it do for a typical situation for affecting the students?
Well, again,
Dr. Richardson.
Yes, I'm sorry. Senator and members of the committee, I think the key piece there is that if we think about funding for education and how it's used, 85% of funding, 80 to 85% of the funding and that is in place for K-12 education ends up going to salaries and benefits for teachers, support staff, administration, et cetera. And so when we think about the kind of cuts that occur, typically the initial driver is that we reduce staff. And oftentimes the attempt is to reduce staff as far away from the classroom as possible. So you increase administrative loads, you reduce EA and educational assistance staff, you try to cut back on transportation and other kinds of costs. But when you have a cut at that level, you almost always end up going back to the classroom. And when you cut back on staff, that drives up class sizes. Districts have tried to be very creative, and I think I would frame North Branch as maybe one of them that has really struggled because they've gone through a number of efforts in trying to pass an operating levy similar to Brooklyn Center. What you see is a continuing erosion of the ability to meet the needs of kids, and then you try to get really creative. So you end up in a four-day week, or you end up with trying to cut back on the number of days of instruction you provide or doing other kinds of pieces. None of those pieces I can see is beneficial to kids. Every one of those has a negative impact on students.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, Chris, and And I'm glad you're the 5 points you hit, specifically the last point on equity, is something I think is theming around this great hall that we represent. And I look forward to, you know, your continued leadership in this area, and specifically as we're talking more about the general ed aid and the equity down in the future. So thanks for
appreciate that. Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see Dr. Richardson. He's, of course, my boss when I'm not here in the other parts of the year. I can ask him all kinds of questions.
So be nice, sir.
Yeah, no, I think we appreciate the leave of absence.
He hasn't.
But that's right. I just also to address the equity part. So do you support, obviously, I believe you do, the general ed levy? And since that may be cost prohibitive, do you see a way that we could put a placeholder in to get at least a start on trying to balance that equity, the disparity we see?
Well, I think, excuse me, Senator Dahl and members of the committee, I think as an MASA organization, we've identified the issue of trying to support greater equity for the school districts across the state.
Right.
And knowing that when there are significant disparities in the level of funding available for various school districts, that it makes it much more difficult for them to be able to provide high-quality educational programming. I think initially the piece that would be maybe the placeholder or the beginning place to start might be looking at, if we take a look at the current level at which we begin to provide equity funding in terms of levies, that I don't believe has changed in 20 years. And I think it's, if my memory serves me correctly, I think it's $470,000 valuation per pupil. Obviously, there's been tremendous changes in valuation since that original piece was set. So an initial strategy might be to begin to build in some kind of an inflationary marker, an inflationary increase to that number, so that would go up as inflation had gone up. If it had, from the original time it was set, there would be a lot more districts that would be continuing to get equalization dollars that would actually support either maintaining the levies that people currently have, or being able, if they've not been able to pass a levy, to be able to say the state is going to try to make this fair for taxpayers, or more fair for taxpayers across the state. So I think if there's a way to either build in an inflationary increase concept, and maybe even it's with just a very small increase to the calculator or the formula amount for equalization, that would begin to get that process going. Even, obviously, as there are not enough dollars, as I understand, to do everything that's on everybody's wish list.
Thank you. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Richardson, just 2 points, and I also appreciate your wisdom and experience. And one thing about the longevity is you usually have the opportunity to have kind of a lot of experience, and sometimes it's a little befuddling as to see how things have changed. But one of the things that I've watched over the years is the erosion of the availability of money for education. And at the same time, we have seen an enormous growth in the area of health and human services. And if you look at, you know, sit on the finance committee, you see these budgets, one will be growing and the other will be kind of flat. And I think that's the story across the country. And I think the current Time magazine has an article about this year, in 2013, Americans will spend, I believe it's $2.8 trillion in healthcare spending. And that, you know, is an awful lot of money. I think the basic issue that is really difficult for us because we're in such a small cosmos is how there isn't enough resources. You can shrink one and maybe add to the other, or shrink another and add to this, and so you're working with somewhat of a defined pool of resources, especially when you take inflation into account. So I think the other point is back in 2002 actually, Governor Ventura had a proposal that was to take over 100% of the general education formula. Before that time, there were two components to general education. One was the fully equalized levy, and the other was the aid part from the state. And that we used to set the the levy and the aid at the legislative level, and at that time, Governor Ventura and his people decided that the state had extra resources at that time that they could take over 100% of that funding. So that passed. What occurred from that point on in 2003 and forward, if you look at the levies, the levies went from about $4 billion up to about now, I think in 2011, they're almost double, over $8 billion. So what we did is we basically changed the education funding policy from a controlled, kind of an equalized process to one that was driving levies. And we did that by equalization. Basically, we put some money into the levies and said, school districts, will equalize this up to $500, and then $700, and so on. And this encouraged the districts to go out and levy. So we have this system now that I'm not sure which way we should turn. It's hard to turn away from levies because that's the source of the revenue for a lot of districts, most districts. But we don't have enough state resources to fully look at backing that levy or that property tax off a little bit. But I do think in the long run, if you look ahead 10, 15, 20 years out for the education system in the state, we need to have a dual system like we used to have, because there will not be enough resources at the state level to pay for that 100%. And I don't think there's a state in the union that does it. And some have tried it, but you just can't maintain it. And so I think we have to take a step back and figure out how we can gradually phase back into this kind of dual system that is fair across all, all districts across the state and across all property owners across the state. And it's a big leap, and I'm sure that's probably why the governor didn't want to add that to his budget as well. But that seems to be, where we are today anyway. And I think this committee has quite a charge in terms of what we should do.
Thank you, Senator Stump. Reaction and an excellent recap of the issue before us.
Senator and members of the committee, and again, yes, we all recognize that some of us are getting a lot whiter after the joys of the superintendency. And actually, back in 2002, I was a superintendent in Osseo. Jesse Ventura lived about a mile from my house, and his kids went to our school district. So, yes, I've had a number of close encounters with that situation. But I think that the key piece, again, at the time that the governor, at that time, made those decisions, obviously, financially, the state was in a good situation. If you remember, we were getting the Jesse checks coming back on a regular basis every year. And as the big plan was rolled out, it not only was to take over those dollars, which then wiped out the general levy and some of the other pieces, but also proposed replacing it with a significant broadening of the other taxes. And as I think all of you remember, we got the 100% funding, but we got none of the broadening of the revenue streams. And you're right. I think at this point, obviously, it is extremely difficult situation for the legislature and for the governor, because you are faced with a limited pool of dollars and a huge number of needs. A couple of things I would frame specifically. One of the things, as you look at Health and Human Services, as you said, they have built-in inflationary amounts in place. In other states I have worked, there have been built-in inflationary amounts for education, so that from year to year, you knew from year to year what would be your increase. You didn't end up being the last thing to be decided in May or June as to what was going to happen. And that would make a significant difference in Minnesota if there was a sense that there was that kind of increase that basically reflected either consumer price index or IDP or whatever. But at this point, my sense is you have to look at ways to basically address both the revenue side and the expenditure side of this process. And that one's one that's unfortunately is firmly in your hands. But I think the other thing is, as we look at funding for education, I don't think there would be a superintendent in the state of Minnesota that wouldn't say to you, if you could put more money on the formula, that would have the greatest potential of supporting school districts across the state. Because it really is, when there isn't enough money on the formula, that drives us to need to look at going out for operating levies, trying to get other strategies to provide additional funding. And you're absolutely right, it did drive between 2001, 2002, when we had kind of the lowest level of operating levies in place in the state, back to a position where we are higher than we've ever been and more disparity than we've ever had because of the ability of various districts to pass levies, especially without equalization in place.
Thank you very much for your testimony and service.
Thank you,
Superintendent.
Appreciate it.
Next, we have Jen Allswager, Education Minnesota. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. And I will keep my comments fairly brief. I know that you are on a time schedule, and I also have to get over to the other body. First of all, I would like to applaud the governor for bringing forward an education funding bill that doesn't have any shifts or gimmicks in this current biennium and addresses the shift in the next biennium, although we are fine with having the shift being paid over time as in current law. Also, we are very happy that he is creating a strong fiscal foundation. As Senator Stumpf mentioned in previous years, you know, we've had an education funding change that was supposed to be funded by a $900 million tax increase, and that never happened. As a result, we got the change in how education was funded, but we did not get the revenue for that. And that is a major reason why we've been facing deficit after deficit. So we are very happy that in another committee they're going to be dealing with the revenue issues. In terms of the education bill, I'd like to focus on a few areas. The formula is, you know, there's money for the formula. We think the formula should be higher because that of many of the reasons that have been mentioned earlier, so I won't go into those. We appreciate some of the funding that is in the bill for, in the budget for teacher growth and evaluation. The bill that was passed in 2011 has a number of requirements that are going to be quite costly to school districts. This is a start in his budget, but as the previous testifier mentioned, it will be there will be significant costs. Education Minnesota is working with other education stakeholders to figure out what actually needs to be funded, and we will be coming forward with a proposal to fund the teacher development and evaluation law. Education Minnesota wants the teacher evaluation law to work. We want to continue to employ those teachers who are doing a great job. And if there are teachers who are not, we want them to go through the teacher improvement process. And if they continue not to meet the goals as stated, there is appropriate provisions in the law where the teacher would be terminated or disciplined or whatever, and we are supporting that. But again, it needs funding. We appreciate the governor's start on all-day, everyday kindergarten. While it isn't fully funded, we start making progress towards that goal of having all-day, everyday kindergarten funded in the future. We appreciate the special education revenue that is being added. And again, you know, fully funding it would take quite a few more million dollars, and we're making progress towards that goal. So another provision I don't think that has been mentioned by others is increasing the English learner funding from 5 years to 7 years, and we think that that's appropriate. Some of those students need the full 7 years of funding. So I'm keeping my comments fairly brief for you today, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Halswager. Questions? Good. Well, we know we'll hear back. Our next testifier is Sam Walseth from the Minnesota Rural Education Association.
Mr. Chairman and members, Sam Walseth batting cleanup today. And I think I can be very brief and say that we concur with and support the wisdom of the Superintendent of the Year, Dr. Chris Richardson, and Senator Leroy Stumpf in his comments about the sort of the history and changes of education finance. And we're very supportive of what the governor is doing by way of making a state investment in public schools, a down payment on closing the cross subsidy, getting to all-day kindergarten. But we do think the $300-odd million he's got slated for K-12 still doesn't get to that inflationary amount in the first year. That 1% amount in the first year is still very thin. And I've asked several of our districts, obviously not a scientific survey, but just to give me some anecdotal feedback about some of the cost pressures that they're facing as they look forward to the next bargaining cycle, the next budget cycle. And one thing that hasn't been discussed much, but it's a very important component to all this, is the impact of the Affordable Care Act on school districts. School districts are going to have to make some new contributions to support staff health insurance coverage. And that's not a bad thing. That's a very good thing. You heard last week from the School Nutrition Association, the school lunch ladies, our cooks, janitors, bus drivers. These are the heart and soul of our districts. And in many ways. And districts are looking at having to make some increased contributions to those health plans under the pay or play part of the Affordability Care Act. I've talked to some small districts, a superintendent with a district of 409 students. He estimates it's going to be about a $100,000 increase in contributions. District a little bit bigger, you're looking at $200,000 in increased contributions. These are important contributions that need to be made, so there's some fairness in health insurance for those support staff, but we do have that increased cost coming our way as the federal health law does implement itself on employers across the state. In addition to that, fuel and energy costs continue to rise. Our teachers have taken very, very sparse and austere contracts over the last 4 years through the Great Recession. We anticipate a lot of pressure at the bargaining table going forward after 4 years of that. And just all of the, the teacher evaluation mandates, what you want us to do in terms of administering bullying, best practices. These are new administrative cost pressures that are coming down on schools. So the cost pressures are there, and we really encourage you to look at trying to increase that target of $300 million to something closer to $500 million, where you can get that first-year amount up from 1% to closer to 2%. That would start to at least cover the basic CPI. Mr. Chairman, I'll be very brief. I'll wrap this up, but there's one thing that is not in the governor's budget bill that has been discussed that needs to be in there, and that's property tax reform for school districts. I think it was noted there are actually, I think it's 28 school districts have $0 in operating referendum and about another 30 that have $1 in operating referendum. That's because the states that go past $1 will give you $126. The average levy out there today is over $1,000 per pupil. You've got a consortium of districts, about 50 districts, who are woefully behind in that some basic equity on that referendum piece. And part of it is due in large part to what was done in the 2001 tax bill. But you've got to look at school district property tax base issues. And for a big group of districts in central Minnesota, not having their seasonal recreational property as part of that referendum market value base is creating a huge problem. You're talking about taking upwards of 20, 30, 40, 50% of that school district's tax base off. Now, we're not saying we want to tax the cabins twice. The state is taxing those cabins, but through the statewide business levy, we think the state is wrongfully taking a local resource and putting it into the state coffers when that really needs to be transferred back to local school district operating referendum. And I know there's a lot of sensitivity to the no taxation without representation argument, but you've really got to look at what that's done to creating an inequity across kind of central and northern Minnesota districts. So we encourage you and the tax committee to really look at the tax base issues, and we support any kind of role in our general education levy that you can put together. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll close my comments.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Walseth, if that seasonal property were handed back to the school districts, how many of the schools that are really hurting because they don't have any referendum would be affected?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I've got a list of about 20 districts where there's 20% or more of their adjusted net tax capacity is off of the referendum market value. And I know I might be speaking Greek at this point, but there's a difference between your total adjusted net tax capacity, which is your whole tax base, and then what districts get to actually do those operating levies on is referendum market value, and that does not include agricultural production land or seasonal recreational property. And so what you see on a map is in central Minnesota, where all the water is and all the beautiful lake homes are, there's about 20 districts in that area, and it's kind of as you go north that are really impacted by that state policy change.
Thank you.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Walseth and Senator Johnson. I happen to represent an awful lot of those school districts in central Minnesota. As I've said many times, it's a beautiful resort area, but those lakes and those seasonal dwellings are the industry of that particular part of the state. And so if you take away that industry, you know, that's the tax base that they need for education. And I think that's part of the argument that we're talking about here.
Mr. Chair,
what
came to my mind as we were listening to this is that, you know, taxation without representation, what about people who, you know, don't have cars or don't drive? They're taxed, too, for our roads and so forth. I would support looking at that issue very carefully.
Thank you.
Senator Bonnell.
Mr. Chair, and I just have to, you know, have on the record that coming from a district that does have high referendum dollars, it doesn't mean that district is high in terms of overall ranking of total dollars coming, because then what happens, members, you know, probably know this, but just to have it said, is that then you get much less aid. And so it is complicated. You know, all of it has to be looked at, because each year I ask council to give me an updated run that includes everything with Title I dollars and referendum dollars and aid dollars, just so I can see for myself kind of where my districts are. And they're right in the middle of the pack. And they're very high referendum districts. So it's complicated.
Mr. Chairman, it absolutely is complicated. What's concerning is a lot of these districts in greater Minnesota are at that sort of even state aid amount and then at the bottom of the levy amount. And so they start to fall into that bottom 25th percentile of district funding. And when the vast majority of new revenue to schools is coming off of operating referendum, it's tough when you're in that position where you don't have a local resource to go and get that money.
Sarah Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Walseth, I agree. And I also know sometimes those districts with less commercial property, their dollar is so much harder, you know, and what they have to get the same value. And so by no means am I saying that it's easier for, you know, for any district. I think each of our districts are stretched in different ways.
Thank you very much, Mr. Walseth.
Thank you, members.
And members, the stage is being set very well in terms of the variety of needs and how we fairly, equitably pay for them. And what is fairness? And we have 67 perspectives in the Senate on that, and that's good. And our challenge will be how we put together that package. And clearly, we'll need to interface with the tax committee. The chair, Chair Scoy, does have some proposals addressing this, and I'm hoping we can have a joint meeting with taxes, which has a similar time slot as we do. So we'll be looking at doing that sometime within the next month. Members, our next meetings are posted. Next Tuesday, we'll consider Senator Scoy's, one of his bills, Senate File 120, and Senator Lurie, Senate File 297. I believe both of those relate to some bonding requests, and which will be seeking some commentary from us and then for referral. On the 27th, Senator Johnson has Senate File 262. There's some others that we may add. We've been contacting authors to see if they're ready. And following a week from Thursday, we have the budget forecast, and that will be in this room. So we won't be meeting. The following week, on Wednesday, March 6th, we're going to have a joint meeting with the House. Earlier, I've mentioned we're awaiting the auditor's report on the legislative auditors on special education, and that information will be available, and we're going to have a joint meeting to go through that report. So that's what we have at this point, and we'll be following up on other items as we've discussed at previous meetings. Any questions or additional comments at this point? Not? Thank you very much. We're adjourned.